600 Reel 9.
Mr. John Wainwright, Reel 9. Are you describing the importance of Gully Ravine to the Allied front? If you'd like to continue.
Yes, well, I've said it was the main gateway, or the main arterial road, if you like to put it, to that front, that gully front, which probably extended a couple of miles or so. And that was the only way in and out for the passage of stores and for wounded, I mean, and so forth. People are going up to the line, to any part of the line, had to go up into the gully and then branch forward there into the trenches on either side.
What did it look like?
Well, it was like a deep valley, a fairly narrow valley there, rugged sides there. And there was a brook, all the water seemed to be coming down from towards Crithia, that's what it was from that area, from the higher ground. And the water went into the sea, the sea entrance. And
there were a lot of people milling about. Was it very busy or?
Yeah, well, it was very, very busy there. Yes, there was always something going backwards and forwards. I mean, there were mules and mule carts, trucks, taking stores up and so forth. People going backwards and forwards to the trenches. On the sides of the gully, there were sort of foxholes where people were resting in reserve there. There wasn't the same opportunity for reserve lines like there was on the other front, and a lot of the people in reserve were in these what I call them foxholes on the side there. Or if you were in reserve further back, you used to spend a lot of time, one man per hole there, sort of dug a hole in the side of the gully, used a ground sheet as a sort of cover, and that was your home when you were in reserve or resting behind the lines.
Where exactly were your battalion and A Company in the line when they were in the line?
Well, I remember there were the part of the line was the Turkish trenches were quite close. It was on the left of the ravine, and the main part of the line that I remember. No, what was the name that was called? Just a minute. Yes, our part of the line seemed to be based on what we call the birdcage. And at that part of the line, the Turkish trenches were quite close, 20 or 25 yards away. And the Turks, by the way, at that time, they were using bombs. They had bombs too. And they used to sling these bombs over the trenches so close together. And to try and stop these things, the troops have put up sort of wire netting there in front of the trench so that the bomb would sort of bounce back again. And that's how we got the name of the birdcage there. And there was, I remember being told there that our people also used to sling over tins of bully beef there, because I mentioned bully beef was something that we got in abundance. We more than ever we want, so we used to sling these chaps used to sling these tins of bully over to Johnny on the other side. The sequel to that was later on. Our engineers had been given some instruction to construct some sort of bomb, you know, to use against the Turks. The Turks were slinging proper bombs at us. And there were the first bombs that I remember seeing or hearing about were called jam tin bombs. So there were the tins of jam, the empty tins of jam, were filled up with bits of shrapnel and bits of metal and whatnot, and some sort of explosive put in there, and a fuse there, and we used to sling these over. So I remember being too, well, in fact, I saw it being done there. And I wasn't too pleased about it. I thought it was not a rather shabby trick there. Well, they would send over a few tins of bully beef there and get the Turks coming there for these bully beef. They seemed to like them, evidently. And then to sling one of these jam tin bombs over to follow, which I thought was not very sporting anyway, if there is anything sporting in war.
At CQMS, would you be, when the battalion was in the line, where would you be? You wouldn't be in the front line.
No, we're only just behind them, not because I used to very often go up there, because I remember that birdcage very, very well indeed. And I remember, whilst I was quite close to the line there, must have gone up to the front there, probably to check up something or other, or see something for some reason. I was coming back there, and I heard a terrific noise of some sort of bang explosion or something. I didn't know what the dickens it was there, and it seemed to burst my eardrums. I looked down, there was a stick there standing there. And what was it? What had happened was the Turks had sent us a rifle grenade. They had rifle grenades as well, that they could send these sort of grenades fire them from the rifle. This thing had come over, and I was going back to drop down my there. I remember that quite well, because later on I found that my hearing was affected there, and it must have dated from that time.
So you'd go up the front to see your platoon sergeant, would you, to ask him what was needed?
I went, yes, and to get information that I told you about that was required. So I remember going quite often to the front line. Because we had to get these accurate returns in about the number of men that were there actually on the books for the rations and so forth. And of course I used to see if there was anything else wanted. And probably to arrange whether there's a rum ration, that they had the rum ration too. So it was just a matter of keeping in touch and part of the duties.
So you weren't separate from the front line, you weren't separate from the fighting soldiers at all?
No, we're only just behind there.
You were in the support line, second line then?
If you called it, we were in some sort of sheltered line just behind there. Not very far behind the front lines.
Would you be attached to company headquarters then, would you?
Oh yes, we were always near to the company headquarters, yes. That's the company headquarters where they, obviously.
Were the officers, you were still fairly remote from the officers though? You didn't, your job wouldn't need much supervision from them, would it?
No, because I used to pass my information onto the company headquarters. And quite candidly, my memories of the officers in the line, and the gullimetry they're very sketchy. I can't remember. I just can't remember having a lot of contact with any officer in the line at all. I don't know why. There it was.
So as far as your life went on independently of the officers. The officers had a different role, but you weren't aware of it at the time.
Well, maybe something of that sort, but it's just as I've said, I just can't understand it anyway. It's not a case of not understanding it, but it just seemed to me that we did not have a terrific, intimate contact with our officers at all. I suppose they came and made their inspection of the lines and so forth. But as a company quartermaster sergeant, I was my immediate officer in charge would be the company commander, not the section officers. So that may have had something to do with it.
Do you think the officers had better living conditions than the men?
Well, there were no good living conditions at all on the peninsula, officers or anybody else, even the commanding officers there with the battalion officers. But obviously the officers had better dugouts than the men had, and that sort of thing. And they probably had better rations, or they had better supplemented rations. Because I do know that that some sort of food ration, not ration, but supplementary food, was obtained for our battalion headquarters from one of the islands in the Aegean, Tenedos, I think it was. Because I remember speaking to one of the battalion officer orderlies who had been down the coast to this and to get eggs and meat and goodness knows what not for the but they, of course, they had to pay for them. But normally they got the same rations as we got, and I suppose they got parcels from home, perhaps like we did, or they didn't get them. I don't know. But they could buy, if they could buy something extra, they had the opportunity of getting it.
When did you become aware? I mean, you've mentioned already that you thought June the 4th was a turning point. How was morale and the general feeling about the whole campaign after the Suvla landing had failed as well? How did you all feel?
Well, I think the feeling was that as the campaign dragged on and after September, and there was no real big action going on, you could hear the firing going on across the Zanzac and Suvla. Knew there was something going there. You just hear the there was a shell fire on our side, with no big attacks going on. Reinforcements were coming very, very infrequently to us. We were vastly under strength. As a matter of fact, whilst we were on the left of the line, that our battalion, the 5th Manchester, were joined up with another battalion. I forget who it was. It may have been the 6th Battalion. To make one battalion under one commanding officer, because by September, the colonel of our battalion, Colonel Darlington, he went off the peninsula with fever. He was sick, and he was the last remaining officer of those who had landed early in May of the battalion. So by that time, there were no officers whatsoever who had landed with the battalion early in May. And as far as the men were concerned, it was something similar, because the casualties that we had, they'd only been partially replaced. So we were about probably half strength or less than half strength in our companies and in the battalion. And I think it was a feeling of, well, we carry on, but I don't think anybody ever expected another big attack coming up, and we just carried on there, and that was it.
How about the weather? September wore on and went into October, of course. Well, how did the weather change?
Well, it was very, very, very hot indeed up to beginning of October, and then it must have started the rainy season, because I remember I spent my 21st birthday in the gully. I remember. I remember that quite well, because it rained all day. And I was back in my little dugout, or foxhole, in the side of the gully near to the stores that we had just behind the line. And that was my 21st birthday there. And we just went on. And there was also this dysentery still going on, perhaps not as bad as it was before. But the septic business, septic sores, they never seemed to find any cure for that there.
What about the gully? It was prone to flooding. Did you have any floods at that time, October, November?
Well, after any rain, I mean, there was always an increase of water down the gully. But I think I missed the... I think I told you that I left the peninsula about the 14th of November. And I think it was shortly after that there was a terrific downpour. And I think the gully was absolutely flooded out.
But that didn't happen. There was no major flooding before.
No major flooding. No, there was an increase of water, and just like flood water coming down the gully normally. But it didn't stop the traffic. It made it a bit of a nuisance. But it was nothing like it was later on.
How cold did it get by November?
Well, it's just like an ordinary British summer, British winter, that's all. We hadn't any snow or ice or something. It was just cold, damp and dreary.
Do you remember any other instance before you taken off ill, but do you remember any other stories you'd like to tell us of the period?
There was one incident there that whilst we were at Gully Beach, and I really can't pinpoint the actual place, what it was. But I remember being down at the entrance of Gully Beach near there, and I remember the adjutant of the battalion, Captain Sanders, coming back to the base there, and he was in quite a state. And he asked me to collect a party of anyone there from the battalion. Cooks, pioneers, orderly, signalers, there were anybody at all. And we had to rush up to some trenches somewhere off the gully. And there was a limited attack going to take place. By C Company, I remember that, by Major Cronshaw. Major Cronshaw had been ordered to make attack on some Turkish trenches. And there was no support on the left of his company. There was a gap in our line there, and the captain gave me an order to collect these men and take over the line there and cover the attack by C Company. I can picture it now. I can see Major Cronshaw, who was the commanding officer of C Company, leading the men of his company over the line there and meeting terrific fire there. They never got into the trenches opposite and had to retire. And that's an incident that's always been a bit of a puzzle to me, but it actually took place. But I can't just pinpoint the actual trenches.
Any other incidents or characters you can recall from the period?
I remember meeting one of the 5th Manchester's years after the war, and he was a captain. He was a sergeant in one of the other companies, C Company, I think it was. And I remember him showing me a company order that he got, for this, that there was to be a church parade in Gully Ravine on this particular Sunday. It was a sort of that anybody who was free could go to this church parade, which was rather surprising to me, because I can never remember anything of the sort happening whilst I was on the peninsula anyway. The nearest approach to a church service that I can remember was that when we went to Imbros for a rest, We were inspected by General Hamilton, as I may have told you before, whilst we were there. I remember that quite well. I remember him addressing the battalion there.
What did he say? Do you remember?
Well, it was a morale boosting, telling us how well the battalion had done, you know, and not the rest of it, and been a credit to the town from which we'd come, and credit to the army and all the rest of it. And I think it was just a morale-boosting lecture, that's all, a talk to us, and thanking us for a part that the brigade had taken. Because there's no doubt about it, there was a chance of a definite breakthrough there on the 4th of June by our brigade. I mean, if it could have been followed up.
And that was Hamilton? That
General Hamilton, Ian Hamilton, yeah. Oh, yes, well, whilst we were there, remember there was a voluntary church communion service there, which is the only service I can remember ever attending on active service. And this, on this island of Imbros, I remember going up going up towards the sea, and there was a sort of little hollow or valley looking out towards the sea, looking out towards Gallipoli. And I remember there must have been 20 or 30 of us there, and I remember attending this communion service there. He set up some sort of table there, rocks or something, and for the service, which again is a memory, one of my memories. It was the only church service that I remember during any active service.
Did you see anything of the Padres on active service?
No, I don't remember there, because the Padre worked very, very hard. I mean, I think for the casualties, people were killed there. I mean, he officiated at scores and scores and scores of things. But I don't remember seeing much of him anyway.
He didn't sort of have a welfare role with the troops then? He didn't come round
I never remember seeing him in the front line at all. Because his job, I suppose, was attending to people of the first aid station, people who were wounded and so forth. People who died, the people who were killed, attended to all the funerals and so forth. But it was a bit haphazard right at the very beginning. I can remember taking a bit of, whether it was one of our signallers or something in one of the A company, which I was, but one of our lads had been killed, and I remember we dug a grave, and I remember buried this chap there somewhere behind the line, and I remember quite well that we made a cross from the boxes, which I think it was some of the stories to come in. I think the boxes of bacon, I think, used to come in wooden boxes. And I think we got some of these. I just put a cross on them, put the man's name and number in, a regimental number and all of the rest of it there. So at the beginning of the campaign, the things were very haphazard about burying people. People were buried in trenches. They were buried anywhere. But
was your religion very important to you during the campaign or during your active service? Did it help you?
Well, I think I told you that when we were on our way from Littleborough to Southampton, that we stopped at Bristol, and some lady gave me a pocket testament. And I remember I carried this with me there, and I must have read it there, because I mean I've made little notes of it. I carried the testament all through the war, and I used to read parts of the testament when we were in reserve. Anyway, that's about all I can tell you about that. But I must have been interested enough to be one of the few who went for the communion service when we went to Embros.
So you fell ill. I mean, that's why you were taken off on November the 14th. How badly ill did you get, and what were you suffering from?
Oh, well, I mean, I think I got everything by that time. I think I was just absolutely worn out. I mean, I couldn't have been more than 67 stone in weight. I mean, I was never very heavy. But my fighting weight was about 10 stone 4, but I must have been down to about 7 stone. And I mean, having this trouble with dysentery and had all this septic sore. And then I fell down, had this jaundice. Another thing, I'd had trouble with my knee. It must have been rheumatism or something. And I think I was just suffering that I was worn out. General debility. Jaundice, general debility. Rheumatism and all the rest of it.
Was it affecting your performance of your duties?
No, I carried on with it up to, I think it was the jaundice that put me off. Up to then, I never dreamt. I never went to the doctor. The doctor was available at battalion headquarters for people who were ill, who wanted to go sick, I never reported sick at all until this jaundice appeared. And then I didn't even know then. I felt just absolutely terrible. And it was only the man that had, the storeman that I had, who was my batman or storeman for the looking after the rations and stores, who worked with me, who told me that I was looking very funny. He said, you better go down to the field hospital, and that was it. And when I went down there, they bunged me straight into bed, and in a day or two I was in the harbour at Embros. I was told afterwards that they didn't expect me to recover. I don't know, I must have been pretty ill, because I went on this hospital ship, Dunvegan Castle, I think it was. And we dropped off, seemed to drop off most of the people who were being wounded and sick and whatnot at Malta. But I was kept on there.
How did you feel about leaving your comrades and leaving the battalion?
Well, I mean, I suppose I was feeling pretty down and you were, I suppose, in a way, really glad to get away from it, I don't know. You just left it and that was that. You know, sort of feeling, I suppose you became numbed in a way. You just took things as they came. I mean, there for six or seven months, I mean, you'd seen or knew about people who joined up with you, people you knew very well had been killed, others been wounded, others were sick. There was hardly anybody left of the old battalion. And I suppose, in a way, you just felt numbed in a way, I suppose.
So you weren't pleased to get away then?
Just like everything else, you just took it as it came. I mean, the doctor said you were ill and you didn't give any choice. You just bunged you off and that was it.
Well, how were you treated on the Dunvegan?
Did I tell you we saw that while we're in the harbour at Mudros, the Kitchener came on board?
No, you didn't.
Did I not tell you that? Well, whilst we're in, we must have been there 2 or 3 days, I should think. And it was in November at that time that Kitchener had been sent out by the War Cabinet, or War Council or something, for an appraisal of the position in Gallipoli. And it seems obvious since that whilst he was there, he gave the order for withdrawal, you know. And I think that's one of the reasons why I got to England, because I mean to get back again to make way for possible casualties and so forth when the withdrawal came on.
Did you actually
see him? But anyway, yes, he came onto this boat there. I can see him now with his great big mustache. You know, your king and country needs. You remember that old cartoon or whatever it was that was on all the hoardings. He was there. Was there? Oh yes, it was Kitchener, all right. I can see him now, sort of the end of the bed of cut or whatever it was, running on board there, just looking down. I don't know that he spoke. He just walked along and just looked at people, and that was it.
Oh, was he as impressive in life as his image? Because that's a very powerful poster.
Well, he just looked like the image you've seen him in, the man. With a finger point, you can't, king and country need you, sort of thing, with this very, very big moustache and stern countenance.
So
yes, he looked very, very impressive. There were some other officers with him, goodness knows who they are. Maybe colonels, or maybe, I don't think Hamilton was there. No, I think Hamilton had been more or less, I nearly said sacked, but he'd been replaced, you know, by that time. And I think it was pretty obvious to everybody who knew. It may not have been obvious to us that we were there at the time. But I think it was pretty obvious to anybody that the campaign was a failure. And so when Kitchener came out and he said, well, come on, get out of it. So that was it. That was the end of the campaign.
The journey home. How are you? What medical treatment were you actually getting?
Well,
for this
I don't know. I can just remember this. Of course, we'd never seen a nurse. We'd never seen a female from leaving Egypt till I got onto this boat. I can remember the very nice sister. I suppose she was a sister, and she didn't be treated very well. I can't remember much about lying in bed for most of the time. I remember the lad in the next cot to me. He died next to me in my next bed. I remember that. Being buried at sea, and that was it. That's about all I can remember about it.
You don't remember what treatment you were given?
No, it's just we're just having rest and some sort of medicine. I don't know.
How quickly did you respond? How quickly was it? How soon was it before you were feeling better or? A bit
well, I suppose it must have taken a fortnight before we got home. At least there, it took us a fortnight to go out. So I suppose it took us a fortnight to go. So I remember that when we got to Southampton, I mean, I was fit enough to walk off the ship and going on to the hospital train, I think it was, to London. So by that time, I was sort of walking sick, so to speak. So I suppose they must have done something about the jaundice. And
where did you go in London? To hospital?
Yes, I went to the Third London General Hospital at Wandsworth. And there were, I remember we took us in bed there for a week or two before I allowed to get up there, so it must have been pretty bad anyway. And then after a few weeks I was transferred to a private hospital. Well, it was a big house there on grounds, some sort of a mansion in Essex, in Gateston in Essex.
In where, sorry?
In Gateston, Essex. And the lady of the house apparently had arranged for part of the house to be used as a convalescent hospital during the war. And we were there, I remember being there for